Just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. Lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And hello, and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and at iTunes on at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 26th, 2011. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today my guests are Heidi Durow and William Todd Schultz. First up is Heidi Durow. She's the New York Times bestselling author of The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, published by Algonquin. It received writer Barbara Kingsolver's 2008 Bellwether Prize for Literature of Social Change. It's been hailed as one of the best novels of 2010 by the Washington Post, a top 10 book of 2010 by The Oregonian, and a top 10 debut of 2010 by Booklist. Ebony Magazine recently named Heidi as one of its Power 100 Leaders of 2010, along with writers Edwidge Dondicott and Malcolm Gladwell. Heidi was also recently nominated for a 2011 NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Literary Debut. A graduate of Stanford, Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, and Yale Law School, Heidi's an occasional essay contributor to National Public Radio. And she is here today, of course, to talk about The Girl Who Fell from the Sky. And if you were at our salon, I think it was back in September, she was a guest at the Pen on Fire's Writer's Salon. And she's here with us now. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Great to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Let's begin, for those who perhaps were not at the salon and are not familiar with The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, talk about how the novel came about.
It started off as my lifelong dream to write a novel, and I started it 12 years ago and really struggled to figure out what the story of the story was. I had become obsessed with a newspaper story I read about a family that died in a horrible tragedy, and the girl survived, and I wanted to set out to write her future, to give her a voice in some way. And I realized, I mean, not too early on, unfortunately, but the reason I wanted to write the story was that I wanted to write a story about a girl who was missing her mother. And I ended up taking the newspaper story, kind of the crux of what happened there, as the inspiration, but then added my own autobiographical elements about being biracial and bicultural and growing up in the Pacific Northwest in a mostly African-American community. So it turned into this mishmash of a lot of personal truths. I mean, the things that happened in the book didn't happen to me, but kind of the ideas around it happened to me, and mixed that in with what would actually have happened to the girl who survived that tragedy.
I don't know if we talked about this at the salon. It really doesn't matter, because I'm guessing that a lot of the people listening were not there, and we have listeners all over the world, actually. So we'll probably be a little repetitive. In any case, I wonder if you would talk a bit about the point of view, the points of view in the book. For instance, Rachel is written in the first person present tense, but when you're from, say, Brick's point of view, you're in third person past tense. And point of view and tense is always a question, it seems, for novelists. Will you talk about how you decided to do these characters and others in various points of view?
That actually was quite organic. I wish I could say I thought of it instantly. I really thought I was going to write the entire story in Rachel's voice, present tense. I wanted the reader to be in her moment, and realized pretty early on, one, it's difficult to pay attention that way as a reader for a sustained amount of time. And then two, Rachel is an unreliable narrator. She's keeping secrets from herself, even. There are stories she can't let herself remember. And I thought, well, now I need another character, so let me bring in a friend of the mother, which ended up being the character Lerone. And she also became an advocate for the mother's position about what happened and telling that backstory. And the other characters really came about quite organically in that way when I got to a point in the story and I realized, oh my, now I need to make sure that the reader knows more about this incident, or this reader needs to know more about this character in a different way to see him in a different light. So the points of view were quite organic, and I hope they serve the story itself. In terms of the tense, that was actually quite deliberate. It's like one of the only things I was very deliberate about, the tense and the time frame of the story. So I really wanted people to be in Rachel's experience, and so first-person present tense worked for me. The difficulty of that voice, though, was that I had to grow her up. I had to grow up her language and her observations from age 11 to age 17. So that was a huge challenge in that. And then the others were told in the past, because I wanted to make sure that the reader realized that tragedies, other people's tragedies, really do have a grand impact on us. And so I don't know if people notice it when they're reading it, but when I talk to them afterwards, they're always struck by the fact that the first part of the book, part one, you meet Rachel after the tragedy, and she grows up to be almost 16 years old in that first part. But all the other characters are stuck in the 2 weeks after the accident. They're still dealing with all of the things that they're feeling because they've been a witness to it, or because they weren't able to help out in that incident.
Talk a little bit more about the unreliable narrator, as you said Rachel is, because that's an interesting thing to get your head around, I think, as a writer.
Yeah, I don't have an official writing background. I write because I love to read, and I wanted to write a book that I wanted to read, as Toni Morrison said. And so, you know, it came about quite because I realized that my story, all of the great drama, really happens off stage in many ways. The tragedy, the accident, happens before the book begins. And the story of the story really is about a developing consciousness. It's a coming-of-age story and a mystery kind of mixed together, and I realized the moment of the story, the grand conflict moment, is not another thing happening, not another great tragedy or event, but it's the moment when Rachel really uncovers for herself and confesses to herself the story of the true story on the rooftop that day, the true story of the tragedy, and is able to integrate all of the missing stories in her life. And so, you know, the unreliable narrator, because I was doing first-person present tense, I wasn't able to let her tell that story until the very end.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Heidi Durow. Her book is The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, published by Algonquin. Would you read to us, Heidi, from the novel?
Yeah, I would love to. I thought maybe I'd read a Rachel chapter.
Sure.
I love the Rachel chapters because she's so dear to me. And, well, let's see what you guys think. I think the only thing you need to know about this excerpt is that the word for mom in Danish is mor.
Okay.
In my diary, I write, this is day two, second day at Grandma's house. I wish I could go back home, home to before the summer in Chicago, back to base housing in Germany when there was me and Robbie and Moa and Pop and everything was okay. Even though there wouldn't be an Ariel, that would be okay too. Aunt Loretta makes pancakes special for me, even though she has no business in the kitchen. Two pancakes and not enough syrup is what she gives me. Syrup that makes a stain in the pancake middle, gone so fast like the pancake is thirsty. I eat exactly what she gives me. Aunt Loretta eats only one pancake, and Grandma none, because her teeth don't set right. There is something dangerous about pancakes, because Grandma watches us eat. How you gonna catch a lizard with your backside loading you down? Grandma fusses at Aunt Loretta. I am smart and know that when she says lizard, she means husband. That is called learning the meaning from the context, because Grandma says it and she touches Aunt Loretta's face at the same time. That means she's talking about being pretty and being worth something and making it count. Aunt Loretta laughs, and so do I. They are happy that I am laughing. It's the first time as the new girl. I don't need a lizard, Mama. When Aunt Loretta says Mama, I think of saying more and how I don't get to say it anymore. I'm caught in before and after time, last time things and firsts. Last time things make me sad, like the last time I called for more and used Danish sounds. I feel my middle fill up with sounds that no one else understands. Then they reach my throat. What if these sounds get stuck in me? I laugh harder, but the real laugh feels trapped inside, too. School is not a first-time thing. I sit in the front, where I always do. I sit quietly, like I am supposed to do. Mrs. Anderson is homeroom and language arts. She is a black woman. I think about this and don't know why. It's something I'm supposed to know but not think about. Mrs. Anderson is my first black woman teacher. There are 15 black people in the class, and 7 white people, and there's me. There's another girl who sits in the back. Her name is Carmen, and she has hair like mine, my same color skin, and she counts as black. I don't understand how, but she seems to know. I see people 2 different ways now, people who look like me and people who don't look like me. Day 2 becomes day 3, and the next day and the next, I count each day in my diary. Each day gets a new page. Grandma thinks I'm adjusting well. She says, I think you adjusting just fine. I want her to put S's on the ends of her words and not say fixin' to when she's about to do something. There's a girl who wants to beat me up. She says, you think you so cute. Her name is Tamika Washington. She says, I'm fixing to kick your butt. Sometimes she pulls my hair. In gym class, she grabbed my 2 braids. I said, ouch, really loud, even though I didn't mean to, and Mrs. Carr heard. She said, Tamika, and blew the whistle real loud, and Tamika said, Miss Kay, I'm just playing with her. Dang! When Mrs. Carr turned away again, that's when Tamika said it. I'm fixing to kick your butt after school. You think you're so cute with that hair. I am light-skinned. That's what the other kids say, and I talk white. I think new things when they say this, like, there are a lot of important things I didn't know about. I think Moa didn't know either. They tell me it is bad to have ashy knees. They say, stay out of the rain so my hair doesn't go back. They say white people don't use wash rags in the shower, and I realize now at Grandma's I do. They have a language I don't know, but I understand. I learned that black people don't have blue eyes. I learned that I am black. I have blue eyes. I put all these new facts into the new girl.
Thank you so much. That was Heidi Durow reading from The Girl Who Fell from the Sky. I'm going to guess that you, as in writing this book, you read it aloud as you were writing it.
I read it over and over.
You're such a good reader.
I'm a frustrated poet. That's what it really is. I wish I could be a poet. I'm not. But I love the sound of words. I love to make it sound more musical and lyrical. And when I was writing it, if I couldn't get through a chapter without stopping, then I knew I had to revise it. And even once I had the complete manuscript done and I was down to those last major three revisions before I turned it in for publication, I would sit down and read out loud for hours. You know, I'd let myself have a bathroom break, but if I stopped or stumbled in any way, I'd just put a giant X by it and realize I had to go back and figure out, oh, those sounds aren't going together very well.
Do you read poetry?
That's exactly what I read when I get stuck, especially when I get stuck, because poetry, you know, it's distilled and it's beautiful language and it's about thoughts and ideas and feelings and that magical enchantment moment. So whenever I'm stuck, I go to Rita Dove and Sharon Olds and William Stafford and Shakespeare's sonnets. You know, I try to tune myself again, because when I'm not writing well or I'm not feeling like the writing is working, I think it's because the sounds aren't right.
Mm-hmm. Well, your writing is lyrical, and I think that what a lot of writers miss out on, and what I actually harangue my students to do, is to read poetry even if you have no interest in writing it, because of what it's going to do for your language.
I think it's so vital. The other thing that I did when I was writing that was so important was that I got a little obsessive, and I would seize on a song that had the same mood or tenor or tone of the scene I was writing or the character I was working with, and I would play the same song 200 times over and over again on the same day. So often when I was writing Rachel chapters, I would listen to this wonderful Nora Jones song called 7 years, over and over and over again. That poor little song is totally warped, even on my digital copy at this point.
So you'd play it as you were writing?
Yeah. And I think it had to do with just listening to the sound of it, but at some point, because I kept hearing it, I could tune it out, and it kind of just became a part of the rhythm I was experiencing as I wrote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I think music can really help put you in the frame of mind, although I rarely hear anybody say that they listen to music with lyrics when they're writing.
I guess that's the reason I play it over and over again, so obviously at some point the lyrics kind of go away. They're part of the sound, they're part of the music as well. And I tried to be careful about the kinds of lyrics I was choosing also, in terms of making sure that the lyrics were serving the mood and the tone of the scene I wanted to write.
Sure. Talk a little bit about bringing the book to print, because I think you went through quite a few challenges in getting your book published.
Challenges. At the time, I would have called it disappointment and severe depression, you know, and now I get to call it a journey, which is, you know, take note if you're out there and you haven't published yet. You'll get to call this a journey at some point.
That's right.
I had a number of challenges. The first challenge was I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew I wanted to write a book. I really didn't know how to do it. I knew how to read books. I knew what I liked in books. And so then the challenge was, how do I write a story of fiction? That took me some time to figure out as well. Had terrible writer's block for a number of years and ended up running my way out of it by training for marathons, because I hate running, and I thought, if I can dedicate all that time to that running thing, I've got to be able to dedicate the same amount of energy and time to the writing. And then when I was finally done, I ended up getting a fantastic agent, big-time New York agent, but she sent it out to about 36 different publishing houses, and it was rejected by everyone. Mostly, not all of them, but most of them said there's no market for a story about a half black, half Danish girl. I know. I mean, now I get to laugh at that too, but I was cried when I found that out. And ultimately, the book became published because it won the Bellwether Prize for Literature of Social Change, created by Barbara Kingsolver. So that day when I got the call from Barbara, I just flipped out because I realized everything had changed. The prize comes with prize money as well as a guaranteed book contract. And then I was off and running. And then I had a new challenge. I had to figure out what was this book really going to look like in the world. When Barbara called me, she said, you know, the judges, hands down, thought your book, your manuscript was the best, but we do have notes for you. And as soon as she said that, I thought, oh, man. So even before I got the notes, I deleted 150 pages of my prize-winning manuscript and then built it back up to what was eventually published in 2010.
Interesting. Yeah. That's great, though, because, you know, it's inspiring.
Well, I mean, I also hate to tell that story because I don't like revision. I mean, it just is so painful because here you are. How do you know when you're done? This is a big question. How do you know if it's good enough? And I guess even now I feel like I'm hoping I could get a 10th anniversary edition so I can go back and make some edits maybe. I think that would be delightful at this point. But the book just, it needed lots of revision, and it also needed, in terms of me being a writer and an artist, it needed a lot of space. You know, I did a lot of growing up. I published a coming-of-age story at the age of 41, and I wish I could have published it at 30, but I, as a person and as an artist, I just wasn't ready yet at that point.
Well, and you also said earlier that I think you said you have an unofficial writing background, which is interesting because a lot of writers at all ages feel that they must go to graduate school and get an MFA in order to consider themselves a writer or to have any hope of publishing.
Yeah, I did struggle with that because I'm a degree junkie, and so I really did think about going back and getting an MFA to add on to all the other degrees and debt I had, and realized, you know, the best thing for me at that time was to figure out what I enjoyed out of books and what I wanted to create out of books instead of going into the community of writers and figuring that out together. I did end up going to writers' conferences and artist colonies where I was able to meet other writers and find a community of writers, but really, I guess the way I started to feel, am I supposed to feel like a real writer at this point? I think that was the point of the question, maybe, but still, I struggle with, am I a real writer at this point? Yes, I published one novel, but I'm struggling with this next one that I'm working on right now, and I just have to realize that it's word after word, and it's being true to the vision that I want to present in the work that I do.
Mm. Well, you know, you've done such a great job with the book and with having a singular voice and just your story is splendid. So I so appreciate you coming on the show and talking about this again.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the invitation. This has been wonderful.
You're quite welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That was Heidi Durow. Her book is The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, published by Algonquin. And I wish we had more time with her. Wish we always had more time, huh? Anyway, this show will be podcast in the next week or two, so you can listen again or direct your friends to the blog, writersonwriting.blogspot.com. And we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we should have William Todd Schultz with us, who wrote a biography of the photographer Diane Arbus. So stay with us, and be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over. one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
On this program do not reflect the views of KUCI or the University of California, Irvine.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we spent the first half hour with Heidi Durow, who is the author of The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, published by Algonquin, and we are back with William Todd Schultz. Before we go on, though, let me just tell you that if you want to find out more about the show, you can go to penonfire.com. Lots there, as well as if you're in the area, especially on November 15th, which is a Tuesday night, we will have another Pen on Fire Writer Salon, and this time it will be with writers Karen Carbo and Meryl Marco. Karen is a fiction writer and also nonfiction writer, has a book on Georgia O'Keeffe coming out, or is it out? No, it's not out yet. It'll be out any day. And Meryl Marco, who was an Emmy Award winning writer, producer for the David Letterman Show, and has done amazing other things. She has a book of essays, Cool, Calm, and Contentious, coming out. They will be guests at the November 15th Salon, and you can find out more by going to the website and clicking on Writer's Salon. So we have William Todd Schultz with us. He has a PhD in psychology and is a professor at Pacific University in Oregon, focusing on personality research and psychobiography. He edited and contributed to the groundbreaking Handbook of Psychobiography, and he curates Inner Lives, an Oxford series of psychobiographies of famous figures. His own book in the series, Tiny Terror, examines the life of Truman Capote. He blogs for Psychology Today about the intersection of madness and creativity, and he's here today to talk about his new biography, An Emergency in Slow Motion, The Inner Life of Diane Arbus, published by Bloomsbury. Hi, Todd.
Hi, thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, great to have you. Great to have you. I have so much to talk to you about in this half hour.
Not a lot of time.
But let's begin by, as we always do on the show, talking about how you came to write a biography of Diane Arbus.
Well, first of all, I should be clear that it's not a biography. It's a psychobiography. So
what's the difference? Let's first talk about the difference.
Well, in psychobiography, the focus is really on the inner life of the person primarily. So you're really trying to investigate the why question behind, say, the art that the person is making. You're trying to get at the subjective origins of the art in the person's personality and life history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so much about... So psychobiography is not primarily about the what, where, how, when, you know, the kind of itinerary that you get in biography. There's plenty of biographical information in psychobiography, but it's not the mm-hmm. chief focus. The chief focus is to interpret the life and the art using psychological research and theory.
Mm-hmm.
But if you read this Arbus book that just came out, Emergency in Slow Motion, it certainly got a lot of biographical information and detail in it, so you'd get a good, solid sense of the basic, most important, most salient facts of Arbus' life. But it's not meant to be thoroughly exhaustive, you know, in the way
mm-hmm.
that most biography is. It's
mm-hmm.
meant to really be an attempt to size up her emotional world and to try to make a link between her emotional world and the photography that she made.
Mm. Well, you know, then I guess I've become a fan of psychobiographies because
right.
I don't read biographies. I tend to not care about the, as you said, about the what, where, and when. But what I love about this book, about your book, is the why, because that's what's interesting to me. And it seems like all biographies that I come across really tend to be about the what, where, and when. And you know, I don't really care.
Well, I think a lot of biography also does sort of get at the why, but it does so in a way that's not especially focused. It's almost like it's done inadvertently. Or there are some biographies that are pretty psychological, but those are usually written by people who aren't psychologists, so when they make use of psychological theory, it's sometimes sort of a tabloid Freud type, you know,
mm-hmm.
approach that I think is usually unsatisfying, you know, if you're looking for real insight into the person.
So how did you come to be interested in psychobiographies? Because I never even heard the term until I came across this book.
I never heard the term until I went to graduate school. It was completely unknown to me. I went to graduate school at UC Davis, getting my PhD in psychology, and just incredibly fortuitously, there was a person there, a fabulous writer and psychobiographer named Alan Elms, who, this was like in the late, late 80s, he was one of the only people really in the world who was doing psychobiographical research that was informed, intelligent, insightful, and beautifully written. And so I ended up taking a seminar from him, which I really at that time could not have taken that sort of graduate seminar anywhere else in the nation. So I just sort of, I was immediately captivated by the whole idea of it because it combined a lot of my interests. I was really interested in art, and I was also really interested in theories of personality, so it was a perfect way to combine my interest in theories of personality, those theories are what you aim at the life in order to understand the psychology of the person. But then it also allowed me to really get into, you know, art and writers. I was really fascinated by writers and the lives of writers. And so it was just this wonderful serendipity that I was able to meet Alan Elms. And then from there, I just realized, well, this is my path in psychology. So I started doing, you know, exclusively psychobiographical research.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay, so talk about this book, Diane Arbus. How did you come to write it?
I didn't really know much about Arbus until when I was in college. I had two girlfriends who were both artists. One was a photographer and one was a painter, and they're both still doing photography and painting. And I think they were reading the Patricia Bosworth book when it first came out, like think it was in 84. So I heard about Arbus in college a bit from girlfriends, but my wife was reading the book much later, around early 2000, and she's the one, my wife Teresa Love, she's the one who suggested that I should maybe think of doing something psychobiographical about Arbus. But I wasn't immediately taken by Arbus. I didn't really... It was way slower going than it usually is for me. Usually I just am kind of thunderstruck by a person, and then I just get totally fascinated by them and start working on them really intensely. I'm writing a book right now, a biography, not a psychobiography, of the musician Elliott Smith, who lived in L.A. for a while. So I was totally taken by him. But with Arbus, it was slower going, but... She's so enigmatic and mysterious and difficult to get a really good handle on that it was a supreme challenge to try to make sense of her and her work. And, of course, I loved her work, too. And so gradually I got drawn into that dark world of hers, and things started to come a little easier.
Hmm. Yeah, you have so many interesting things to say, really, about her. And she was, you know, I didn't know much about her at all, except, well, something happened, and I wonder what that was. Let's see if he calls back. Oh, no. Hopefully he'll call back. He somehow got let go. So we're going to talk more about the book. Sorry about that. I'm going to put on some music, and we should have him right back. So don't go anywhere. Okay, we have him back. Hi again.
Sorry. My phone flipped over and hung up.
Not a problem. I was about to ask you about her, because I didn't realize how complicated she was. I had no idea that Howard Nemiroff was her brother, the poet Howard Nemiroff. And
yeah.
And you in the book you talk about how she came to photograph freaks because she herself felt like a freak or like an outsider, and I found that really interesting.
Yeah, when she first started doing the freaks work, she always described it as naughty and perverse and nasty, and I think for her, which are interesting terms to use, kind of confusing, puzzling terms to use, but I think for her it was kind of almost in a fundamental way a form of just misbehavior or doing something she wasn't supposed to do and going to places she wasn't supposed to go to. You know, like I talk about in the book, as a child she kind of lived the life of the historical Buddha, because she was kept in this really protected space from an extremely wealthy family, and she suffered from, as she put it, this feeling of immunity and exemption, and her wealth was humiliating and shameful to her. And so going out into this world of freaks as an adult, it always struck me as an antidote to the privation that she felt as a child. And in her family, you know, she and her brother Howard were considered kind of strange and freakish by her mother, just because they were so different and they were into art and esoteric subjects and really creative. And so, yeah, I think the freak work is a lot of things, obviously. I mean, I don't pretend this is the total explanation, but I think it's almost kind of a covert autobiography.
Hmm. Yeah, really interesting stuff. Could you read to us from the book?
Sure.
Just a, you know, just a couple minutes.
Absolutely. I'll
and if you just tuned in, we are with William Todd Schultz. His book is An Emergency in Slow Motion, The Inner Life of Diane Arbus, published by Bloomsbury, and he's about to read.
Okay, this is just from Chapter 1 that's titled Essential Mysteries. One of photographer Diane Arbus's first pictures, she says, was of a dog. She was living at the time on Martha's Vineyard. A big mutt with Weimer and her eyes, gray eyes, arrived every day at twilight as if to signal the oncoming night. It was very haunting, Arbus said. He would come and just stare at me in what seemed a very mythic way. He didn't bark, scratch, fetch, or lick. His intent was not to play or get petted. He had little doggishness. All he did was witness. All he did, Arbus said, was look right through her. He wasn't the least bit interested in seeing what was really there. She didn't think he liked her. She took a picture of him, but it wasn't very good, or so she said. One of Arbus's last series of photographs was of the institutionalized mentally retarded, whom she found the strangest combination of grown-up and child she'd ever seen. These pictures were later assembled posthumously for the book Untitled. The light, again, is crepuscular. In many shots, it's Halloween, so her subjects wear masks and costumes that look for the most part handmade, primitive, and thus even more eerie. They stand in pairs or threes, in groups headed for some unearthly rite, some darker oblivion. At first, Arbus adored these subjects. She went back to photograph them over and over. Finally, what I've been searching for, she exclaimed. Then she reversed her position. The pictures were no good. Her art was not doing it for her anymore, she said to a friend. Why the reversal? Why? What weren't the photographs doing? Shortly after this about-face, Arbus was dead. She was found on the evening of July 28, 1971, by her friend, mentor, and lover, Marvin Israel, who'd been unable to reach her by phone. She was, in the words of the medical investigator, crunched up in bathtub on left side, wearing red shirt, blue denim shorts, no socks. She weighed 100 pounds. The skin of her face had sloughed off due to decomposition. Hair could be pulled out readily. Final cause of death was listed as incised wounds of wrists with external hemorrhage, acute barbiturate poisoning. Arbus left little to chance, it seems. She wanted to die. Or did she? There had been no known prior attempt of any kind, no acts of self-harm, no grim practice runs, no suicide rehearsal, as one often finds in such cases. By hurting herself so severely, had she really aimed to punish? But if so, whom? On the July 26th page of her appointment book, she had written ambiguously, Last Supper. Perhaps, like Christ, she imagined a resurrection. Nothing about her life, her photographs, or her death was accidental or ordinary, Richard Avedon said. They were mysterious and decisive and unimaginable except to her, which is the way it is with genius. After years of seeing what no one else could or would dare to, Arbus suddenly found herself in the awkward and probably enormously disorienting position of interrogating a kind of absence, the unself-conscious, mentally retarded. All of Arbus's other subjects had seen her into being. They gave her something back. They reacted to her presence. The camera made them pliable. She defined them, and they returned the favor. They were self-conscious, and they had the effect of increasing Arbus's consciousness of her own self. The mentally retarded took far less interest. They did not meet her gaze. They exchanged no secrets. There were no intimacies. They gave off no reflection. Arbus was left alone with her single self, and it was not enough to sustain her. Her art, as she said, was not doing it for her anymore, and in crucial respects, she was her art.
Mm. Thank you so much. That was William Todd Schultz reading from An Emergency in Slow Motion. You have an awful lot to say about the process of creating art and what artists go through. And I find it interesting, something you say toward the end of the book, you say a lot of artists go dark in order to create. If that leaves their lives hard to live in, hard to step back into after the descent is made, the art benefits proportionally. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I've always been drawn to people to write about who are haunted and tormented and go to very dark places to make their art. And it's really a supreme risk, because sometimes when you go down to those dark places, the art has a fire and an intensity that you wouldn't get otherwise, but it's hard to get back out of those dark places sometimes. You just go so dark that everything becomes dark. It's sort of like Orpheus going down into the underworld.
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated by people for whom torment is their muse. Basically, it's the raw material for their work. And I think that was true of Arbus. And I talk a little bit about Sylvia Plath as a comparison in that last chapter, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was certainly true of Plath, who, you know, also went to very dark places to make her art. And it's true of Elliot Smith, the person that I'm writing about now. But I find it inspiring, though, in the end, even though a lot of these people met very sad ends, just because of the daring and the courage to risk so much to make the kind of art that they feel like they absolutely must make. It's who they are, and it's the way that they need to express themselves, and they don't compromise. They do what it takes to get to the raw material that they need. But, you know, with Arvis, when your art is a covert autobiography and what you keep seeing reflected back to you in the photographs is the stuff inside of you that's been so painful, it creates a feeling of, you know, being besieged almost by your own work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Do you find, because it sounds like you've studied writers, or at least have insight into how writers work, have you found that madness or mental disturbances are more common in writers, or is it just that writers, artists, whatnot, creative people, or is it just that artists and creative people, writers and such, make their madness visible through art?
That's a good question. It's kind of like a chicken and egg type thing. But there's a lot of psychological research on correlations between mood disorders and creativity, and I think that's pretty much a settled opinion, that people who are really creative are more inclined to have labile moods, be, you know, emotionally reactive, and have problems with depression, and possibly a form of bipolar disorder called cyclothymia, which is a less severe cycling between highs and lows, where you never get to the high highs and you never get to the low lows, but you're still kind of having a lot of mood fluctuation. So there's a lot of research on that. That book by Kay Jamison called Touched with Fire reviews a lot of that stuff. And there's other stuff that's been done on that subject, too. I think it can be overstated, because it's not the case that every artist is tormented or sad or suffering or leading a miserable life. There's plenty of very happy, healthy, psychologically sound, sanguine artists, obviously. But I do think there's a subset of artists whose art is mobilized by their psychological pain. So then the work becomes an attempt to express that pain, and the work just keeps mirroring the pain back, which can sometimes be problematic.
Hmm. In your book, you talk about, about Catherine Harrison with her memoir, Kiss, and how her, her memoir, she found a way out. It wasn't, it didn't have the same effect on her going so deep in as, say, other writers like Plath or other artists like Arbus.
Yeah, I know. I came to know Catherine Harrison, and I've talked to her quite a lot. And I've asked her that exact same question. It's like, you're kind of a marvel because you've stayed alive after going to probably one of the darkest places ever, incest. You know, that's really, when it comes to taboos, that's pretty much near the top of the list. And, but, you know, I think she has been pretty open about saying that suicide was a constant lure for her, too, you know, and... she's had a lot of psychological difficulties through the years. She seems to be doing fabulously now, but yeah, it's a mystery why some people are able to recompensate after, you know, the difficult work, and other people are not. I think they're just like infinite numbers of individual differences that account for that, and mitigating factors like what else is going on in the person's life at the time and what kind of support they had. With Arbus, she had lost a lot of relationships at the end of her life. She was having a difficult time with her lover, Marvin Israel, who was wanting to end things. She'd been divorced from Alan Arbus. Her daughters were away at college and elsewhere, and she was pretty alone at the very end. So there wasn't a lot, there weren't a lot of people that she could reach out to that could get her through this suddenly very, very dark time in the last couple weeks of her life.
There's so much more to talk to you about. I feel like I say this all the time on this show. You know, we have a half hour and we think that's enough, and it's never enough.
About 3 hours or so to do it right.
Hey, any surprises along the way? Did you, did the book end up being what you thought it would end up being? Or did anything else happen that you said, oh, wow, okay, we're going this way?
You mean, am I happy with the finished product and the reception and how it's been going and everything?
No, I guess I'm talking more about the writing process itself and what you found out. I mean, it's pretty clear you were doing a psychobiography of Arbus, but did you find anything out along the way, maybe about her or even about your own process that surprised you?
Well, it was interesting because I wrote the Arbus book over a long stretch of time in fits and starts, which is something I would never recommend to anyone if they can possibly avoid it. And so when I wrote the final half of that book, I was also at the same time writing the Capote book that came out in April nonstop. And I wrote that book and the Capote book in about 4 months, just nonstop. And I was at the same time writing the Arbus book. And I felt like with the Capote book, because I had such... I was on sabbatical at the time. I'm a college professor, as I think you mentioned at the outset. But so I was able to just really, every single day, enter back into the flow. And I felt like the Capote book had this incredible flow that came very naturally and very easily to me. With the Arbus book, it was just rougher going, I think, because it's very dark and it is depressing to spend so much time thinking about these dark subjects. Capote's dark too, but since he's so impish and amusing, when I was writing the Capote book, I had this carefree mindset almost as I was going through the Capote book. And the Arbus book, I had a much statelier, more subdued, sober kind of mindset.
Sure.
And one thing that was really interesting to me was when they both were done, I always feel like they were written by two different people practically, because You know how you sort of unconsciously adopt a style or a voice as you're writing a book, and you don't necessarily always choose it. They just fell into different kinds of voices. And the one voice, the Capote voice, that book was just lighter somehow, even though Capote's story is very sad too. With the Arbus book, it was just more ornate in a way, and also more restrained and sober or something. I don't know. So it was really interesting to write both of them for a stretch of like 4 or 5, 6 months at the same time, going back and forth. And I'd work on one for a while and feel like it was going fabulously, and then I'd hit a natural kind of stopping point, and then I would just turn to the other one and work on that for like a week or two, find a stopping point, and then go back to the previous one. So when I first started doing that, I was thinking, oh, this might be absolutely impossible to try and do these at the same time. But it turned out to work out pretty well.
Wow. Well, I love the book, and I'm so glad.
Thank you so much.
You were able to come on the show, and would love to have you back sometime. Maybe when it goes into paperback or something, we could talk more.
That'd be fabulous. I had a really great time.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you so much. That was William Todd Schultz. His book is An Emergency in Slow Motion: The Inner Life of Diane Arbus. That's all the time we have for today. If you want to know more about the show, visit penonfire.com. Until next time, thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine.